follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Welcome to New Horror Express. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and normally I would say here that New Horror Express is your fortnightly show talking to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer, which has not been true of late because of various reasons connected to my move a few months back from Edinburgh to Wellington. However, fear not, as I'm hoping to get back to a fortnightly schedule in either February or March of 2022. Also, I already have a number of great interviews that are in the queue to be edited, so you will not be getting rid of me anytime soon. Plus, the Guilty Pleasures podcast will also be making a return in January, in fact, next week. But now on to today's podcast, where I'm talking to writer-director Josh Stifter about his latest feature, Greywood's Plot. We also talk about the practicalities of shooting on a shoestring, his animation work, and his filmmaking experiences alongside the likes of Robert Rodriguez and Kevin Smith, plus a whole lot more besides, all of which you can hear right now in my interview with Josh.
Hey, New Horror Express listeners. This is Andrew and Brandon from Namely 90s.
Our 12 Days of Christmas specials are back for a second year.
Starting Tuesday, December 21st, we'll be dropping a special episode every day through New Year's Day.
That's right, that's 12 whole episodes to tide you over this holiday season, while your other favorite podcasts are taking a well-deserved rest.
But that's not all. These aren't any normal episodes of Namely 90s. No, we will be bringing on other podcasters as guests and looking back at some memorable and some horrible holiday special episodes of our favorite 90s television.
So if you're out doing some last-minute Christmas shopping, looking to escape from your family get-together, or wanting to feel a little extra love from us and our blanket of nostalgia, we are kicking off our 12 Days of Christmas specials Tuesday, December 21st.
Find it on your platform of choice at namely90s.com/listen. And make sure to check out Scott on Friday, December 31st, New Year's Eve, who joins us to talk about the X-Files episode, How the Ghosts Stole Christmas.
Hi, Josh. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, good, good. How's it going over there?
It's going well. You know, I'm in the process of editing another movie and getting some things done, but I'm doing well.
Excellent. Good to hear. And so we've got you on the show today to talk about a bunch of things, but I think we're going to start with Greywood's Plot, which I watched recently and played at Fright Fest a few months back. First of all, for the audience, can you give a little plot synopsis for Greywood's Plot?
Yeah, it's about Greywood's Plot is like it's a black and white throwback to the sort of weird B genre movies I grew up watching. It's about two friends who get a videotape sent to them anonymously that has a phone number for a guy named Doug Greywood's, and on the videotape there's footage of a supposed chupacabra. Not very good footage, but something that at least gives these two wannabe cryptozoologists a reason to go in the woods to film potentially one last time before they quit. And then of course in this woods madness ensues.
Indeed it does. You said like it's a tribute to the various B-movie films that you watched growing up. What were the kind of key influences, and how did you come up with the kind of concept for them?
The influences were many. And this movie kind of came together on its own. I'd say the biggest influences were actually the independent filmmakers that I sort of grew up watching. People like Robert Rodriguez and Kevin Smith and all the filmmakers from the 90s who kind of just went out and made something. And that was sort of how this came to be. We didn't really have a script when we started. We didn't even have a full idea. I just knew that I wanted my best friend Daniel to turn me into a monster. That was the whole idea. And we had a kind of a 40 note cards laid out. We were going to try to do it mumblecore, and we went out in the woods and we started filming because I had decided at a certain point that I had to make a movie. I was going to make a movie, but before I turned 30. And then I turned 30 and hadn't made a feature film. And it was like the one thing on my bucket list. So I just went, screw it. We're going out, Daniel. For my 31st birthday, we're going out in the woods and we're going to make a movie together. If it's bad, it's bad, but we got to go try. So we went and tried and failed miserably. And then I ended up going on Robert Rodriguez's Rebel Without a Crew, and I made my first movie, The Good Exorcist. And when we came back, I was like, dude, we have nothing to lose. We made our first movie. Let's go finish that other one. Let's actually write it and figure out what's important for us to say and what we learned when we tried the first time. And that's kind of how Greywood's plot came to be. But as we were writing it, that's when we started digging deep into the true influences, which were sort of the, the B movies that we grew up making fun of, but then kind of falling in love with, the Mystery Science Theater 3000 movies, the stuff like The Brain That Wouldn't Die and, Ed Wood movies and stuff like that. And we were like, well, what if we kind of took those really bad B movies and then we grabbed some influence from movies that we thought were really great, like Terror is a Man, Island of Dr. Moreau story, like those kind of like Island of Dr. Moreau stories. What if we took that and made our version of that? That's sort of what it all came from, was trying to make our own little Frankenstein monster movie.
And so once you started like the second time coming back around to like working on the script, how long was the writing process?
I wrote it pretty quick, because at that point we had done our sort of dry run of filming the first round, and I had been stewing with these ideas for a while and writing down note cards and writing down little dialogue pieces and stuff over the course of the year or 6 months it took me to make The Good Exorcist. And then when I started writing, I actually kind of just sat down over a couple weeks and just wrote it. It didn't take me very long at all. And then I sent it to Daniel as I was writing it. I would send him pages and he would clean them up and write new dialogue, kind of fix things. Or he'd be like, hey, what if we tried a scene like this? So it sort of was this back and forth process between the two of us. But it really didn't take us long, maybe 3 weeks altogether to get a script written to go back out and film again.
So did you go back out and film again kind of immediately? Because one of my questions was going to be like, how long did it take from kind of script into filming? It seems like that a very quick process.
So this was a weird one because we had filmed before. So I had a bunch of footage of stuff that we had filmed. And we had done like improv dialogue, and we had written a couple scenes while we were on set. And I took what we had in the footage from a year earlier. And when I wrote the script, I'm like, well, I could maybe use this shot and I could maybe use this place we had. So I started building it from there. But then from the point that I started writing, we went back and started filming almost immediately. Well, and by back, I started writing things when I started rewriting things. I was like, well, what if we don't just film the whole thing in the woods? I could film some scenes at my house. I could film some scenes at a local bar. And I would write a scene for a local bar and I would just put out a Facebook post and be like, hey, are there any bars in the area that would be cool with me filming? And we'd get one that would say like, hey, yeah, you could totally come out here and film on Sunday morning. And we would just pack up and go film that scene. So we just sort of like, we sort of just did it all on the fly. Like we just made it up as we went, where we were like, hey, we have a weekend. Let's go shoot my sister's woods. And we did have the full script written, but we were also coming up with stuff as we went. I mean, one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie is this dinner sequence at the end, near the end of the movie, where one character can't talk and has to just knock yes or no, like once for yes, twice for no, or whatever. And that scene we wrote 2 weeks before the movie was due for its first film festival. It had already gotten into the festival. and they were like waiting for us to send the final in. And I was looking at the movie and watching it one last time. And I'm like, there's a pivotal scene missing at the end of the movie. And I was laying in bed thinking about it. And I'm like, I've always wanted to do like a dinner scene, like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 style dinner scene. That's just an awkward moment between characters. And I wrote it, I sent it to Daniel, and he's like, oh, this is good. We got to film this. And he found us a location, the three of us, me, Daniel, and Strauss. Strauss plays the fly man in the movie. The three of us went out there together and just filmed that. And I edited it. I cut score with score from the entire movie. So if you see that scene, it's just score repurposed into that scene that plays from like the first score of the movie to the last score of the movie, and put it in there, sent it off to the film festival. And that scene was done like last minute. So from the day we started, the day I wrote the script to the day we finished ending was 2 days before, or 2 weeks before we went to a film festival.
Wow.
Which was about a year, about a year.
Okay, yeah. I was also wondering, did you, you know, this being your second feature, your first one being the Good Exorcist, did you find this easier to direct or the same, or what was the...
Well, the Good Exorcist was made with a reality show. So I had like a film crew following me around. We had a ton of rules and regulations, and we had to film it in 14 days. So there were elements of that one that were a lot more challenging in the moment because of the way I had to do it. But the challenges of Greywood's plot were that there was just more riding on it. Like the other movie, The Good Exorcist, I knew it wasn't going to be a masterpiece. I knew it was going to be schlocky. I knew it was going to be bad. I mean, in 14 days of filming a feature film in the modern era, it's not the same as when El Mariachi was made. Like, it's just not. It's never going to be that same thing. So with that one, I knew sort of what I was in for. With Greywood's plot, I had to make something that was really important to me, and I knew I would be willing to put the work into finishing, and I was in it. So that made it a lot more of a challenge to actually, you know, act. And there are scenes in that movie where I was the only person on set filming myself. So there's an obvious challenge in that that wasn't in The Good Exorcist. With The Good Exorcist, I also had like the backing of Robert Rodriguez. Like there was this sort of, I don't know, overlying knowledge that there was someone there guiding me. With Greywood's plot, I was alone, like constantly. Like I had Daniel, Strauss, and Keith there the whole time. But if I didn't keep going, no one was going to be like, Josh, you got to keep going. With The Good Exorcist, someone was going to be there going like, hey, if you quit, this reality show doesn't get made. So you have to keep going. With this, there's no one cared. No one cares until it's done and they can see it. So I definitely think Greywood's plot was probably more of a challenge to actually continue on and keep my pace and keep the energy going and to really figure out what I wanted to do. But I learned from both of them, and they both are no budget movies. So there was something, there's just passion driving both of them, just in different ways.
With The Good Exorcist, you were talking about like, you know, Robert Rodriguez being there. Are you meaning like his people, or was he like kind of directly involved with the filmmakers in that show?
Yeah, he was directly involved. We would go to his in the first, like, I don't know, the first week that we were there, it's like the first three episodes of the show or something like that, we were working with Robert directly, asking him questions, like, you know, sort of, he was letting us borrow some props from his set and stuff, or his studio and stuff like that. And he came out to set one time, which was pretty funny. You could see it in the show. If you watch Rebel Without a Crew, there's a time where I'm filming a girl in my bed getting an exorcism from the priest while he's dancing and listening to death metal. And Robert walked in, and on the show, you can see it kind of, but Robert knocks on the door and I'm like, hey, I'm fucking filming in here. And they don't show the fuck. You don't hear the fucking part on the show, but I have the footage that I've always like threatened to put out there someday. But I'm like, come on, I'm fucking filming in here. Leave me alone. And Robert just walks in. He's like, no, you're not. Ha ha ha, I'm here. And then we end up like having this long conversation while there's a girl in like a nightgown chained to my bed. And we're talking about like sliders and lenses and things. And she's just like covered in like that. We use that charcoal toothpaste to look like nasty vomit all over her mouth.
Yeah,
So she's like covered in that, laying in the bed awkwardly while Robert and I are just talking about lenses. So he was very involved and also like, you know, watched the movies and gave us not critiques, but he pretty much was just like, hey, I really liked this scene and I really liked this. Good job. Way to get it done. And then I ended up actually working on, he did a $7,000 movie as well called Red 11. And I ended up working on that. So it's been great, you know, kind of working with Robert throughout the years and doing some stuff with him. Even after Rebel Without a Crew, but Rebel was such an amazing experience just to be able to like go, a lot of independent filmmakers were not able to go 100% all in on the independent movie we're making. But because of the reality show, I got to just live filmmaking for 5 months. Granted, it kind of sucked because I had a 1-year-old and a 4-year-old at home that I had to leave with my wife for 2 months or whatever, however long I was gone. And Daniel, who plays Father Gill in the movie, and Doug Greywood's in Greywood's Plot, he had just had 2 twin babies like weeks before and had to leave them to come film the movie. So we were just kind of like 2 dads on a weird filmmaking vacation, but it was a lot of fun. And being able to work with Robert was very inspiring. There was one moment where Robert was in the process of finishing up Alita Battle Angel, and the set that he had built in his back lot, there was like a chunk of this set that cost $7 million. And I remember at one point I was sitting on this $7 million set in a director's chair editing my $7,000 movie and thinking like, this is the coolest moment of my life.
That's pretty surreal. Mind you, probably actually not as surreal as your previous story about the woman chained to the bed while you talk about lenses.
Well, there is also a moment where there's a scene in The Good Exorcist where Father Gill gets sent to hell, and the hell sequence, we actually end up filming at Troublemaker Studio, and I had Daniel kneel in hell before Abaddon in this big parking lot, which is the parking lot that they filmed Planet Terror in, which is one of my favorite like weird, you know, grindhouse B movie. I mean, obviously part of the grindhouse series, but I love Planet Terror. And there's that scene at the beginning where Bruce Willis walks out of his Humvee and then he like starts to mutate, and that's where Daniel was kneeling, was in that parking lot. And I just thought it was so cool, like Daniel was kneeling in hell in the same place that Bruce Willis stood in Planet Terror.
Nice. Yeah, that was real
cool. That's still surreal every time I watch it. I'm just like, fuck, it's the same place. We actually got to film there.
Yeah, that's awesome. In terms of like, kind of going back to Greywood's Plot for a minute, what were the kind of greatest challenges, or was there any kind of on location?
We face challenges left and right, in as much as when you have no budget, you don't, especially the first time around when we were figuring out, I mean, we failed miserably. Looking back, it's like you, about an eighth of the footage that you actually see in the movie is stuff we shot the first time around, and that's like B-roll stuff and just some nice shots. And when we, the whole movie is centered around them finding this footage that takes place where this like birdhouse is sort of falling on a slant. When we went back the second time to film, that birdhouse was gone. It had fallen over and rotted into the ground. So like going back to the location and being like, okay, we'll film a couple scenes at this birdhouse, it almost felt like the movie, like us, like the way the boys are like going through the woods trying to figure out, well, what the fuck are we going to do to make something out of this? That's what we felt like going into it, being like, what are we going to do? There's that, there's a really great moment in Greywood's Plot. That's one of my favorite moments because of the way it all kind of came together. But there's that scene where Dom sets up the camera and he's giving this like tirade into the camera, and it seems like he may be losing his mind. And then Doug comes up behind him and hits him in the back of the head with a bat. And we filmed that the first time around. Like that was filmed years before the later footage, almost 2 years before all the rest of the movie was shot. And the fact that those two clips, or that clip works in the movie, is almost miraculous, because Daniel and I aged 2 years of dad years, which is like 20 years. We look way older than we did the first go around. And that's one of the reasons we made the movie black and white, because we were looking at the footage and we're like, this is great, but how are we going to convince people that this was filmed at the same time? We are older. Our hair is getting grayer. I'm wearing different glasses than I had at that time, and I didn't have those glasses anymore. And we just realized if we went to black and white, people don't pay as much attention. They kind of just let things go. So we owned it. We also, one of the other weird things about that movie that we faced kind of as a challenge was because we were filming in Minnesota throughout like a period of years, literally, but also like in these weird chunks of time where we're like, hey, I've got 5 days off of work. Let's film a chunk. We were facing all of the Minnesota seasons, and our weather changes in Minnesota like every 5 days. It's never the same. So if you watch that movie and you pay attention, you'll realize like it goes from flowers in the spring at the beginning of the movie to obviously summer with like leaves in the trees and the guys are sweating to leaves falling off of the trees. There's like one shot where leaves are just downpouring. White leaves are just downpouring. And then all of a sudden, all of the leaves are gone. And by the end of the movie, there's snow falling. And all of that happens in the course of this movie, which is apparently supposed to take place over like maybe a week. So we go through all four seasons in a week. And I think because it's black and white, we get away with it.
Yes, I think so. I think so. I mean, I definitely didn't notice.
Like, no one does. I don't even notice when I watch it unless I'm really paying attention to it. But I think it helps make the woods seem bigger, because we filmed in a plot of land that was like a quarter of an acre, like a tiny little plot of land. And we had to make it look like it was, you know, 100 acres. So we basically did, not intentionally, but the way we did that was by the seasons changing, just makes it all look different. But if you actually pay attention, you'll see like certain trees where you're like, they're just walking around the same tree over and over again.
Yeah. From your description there, you know, like I was born, you know, like I've recently moved to New Zealand, but I was born and brought up in Scotland, and it sounds like Minnesota is similar in that, you know, like in Scotland you can get like four seasons in one day kind of thing.
Yeah, Scotland, big time. Scotland is. I went to Scotland for a couple of weeks for my mom's wedding. That never happened, but I thought it was gorgeous. And I actually filmed some things in Scotland that I'm using in my next movie. Just kind of not B-roll, but some. It's hard to explain. When you see the movie, you'll be like, "Oh, he was in Scotland." But it was so gorgeous, and like instantly just wanted to film. Like everywhere I went, I'm like, oh God, I want to make a movie here so bad.
Out of interest, just where were you in Scotland?
Where was I in Scotland? I don't actually remember exactly where. I'd have to ask my wife.
That's no problem. We can move on. If you remember at any stage, you can always interject. So I was also going to ask, like a lot of indie films, you wore multiple hats on this production. You were a director, actor, producer, visual effects. I was wondering, like, what your favorite and least favorite roles were in amongst them.
Oh, sorry. Now I'm looking up Scotland because I'm so curious where I was. But my least favorite part of it. Well, I mean, honestly, the visual effects were very, very tedious. It's really hard to explain how many visual effects went into this movie, because it's so much more than you think. Right. It's so immensely huge. It's almost like a big budget movie. And that's why it's really hard to talk about the budget or to explain what the budget was, because if I had paid myself, it would have cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to do all of the work I did, but because I could just do it myself. But we replaced, like, every sky in the movie is a digital sky. Every not just the visual effects that you watch and you go like, okay, he added that, or that monster isn't real. Like, that's obviously a digital effect when they're running through the woods. There are so many other visual effects, from lens flares to, the movie opens with Doug sitting in this chair with covered in flies, crying with a tear dripping down his eye or down his cheek. That tear was a digital tear. Like, I had to actually film a little drop falling down a little green screen piece that I then digitally put onto Daniel's cheek. And like, half of those flies are real and half of them are fake. Yeah, it was just like, every shot has a digital effect in it. Even, you know, I wanted the whole movie to have this sort of like dustiness to it, so I would just put dust into the air just to like spruce up a shot. So every shot has like some kind of digital effect to make it kind of feel Wizard of Oz-y. But I also loved doing that. There's something like very cathartic about going through it shot by shot and just making everything kind of pop and giving it something pretty. And then when I see it on the big screen, I'm like, oh, that's a great shot. And it wouldn't have been a great shot if I hadn't put that extra like love into it. So I really can't say any part of it was something that I didn't like or that I don't know. I kind of loved it all.
Okay. I mean, that, yeah. And that's
good. I will say, like, the thing I didn't like is, as a director, sometimes you get in your own head. And there were certain moments that I look back at, and there's one scene in particular that always makes me laugh when I watch it because it's so funny. It's when the boys first walk up and find the Chupacabra skull, and, you know, Dom is all excited to have found the Chupacabra skull. And at that point, Miles kind of snaps and he's like, man, I'm not getting paid for this shit. I don't want to be here. This sucks. And for some reason I had got in my head and I made Keith do those lines probably 100 times. Like, it just never sounded right to me. And I was like, can you do it one more time? Just one more time. Can I get it one more time? And I made him do it over and over and over and over again. And then I got into the edit and I used the first take. Like, and it just, it's one of those things where it bothers me the time we wasted that we could have been doing something else. And I think it taught me a lot about the, I don't know, it's like the way as a director, you can get in your own head and overthink something. And sometimes moving on is the best thing to do, or actually thinking about it, not how you feel in the moment, but what's going to work in the edit.
I was wondering as well, though, like, if you didn't have like a least favorite, is there any one of those that you find the most challenging? I realize you have quite a lot of visual effects experience, but I was wondering if any of the other roles, directing, acting
is definitely the one. I mean I'm not an actor. The only reason I acted in it was purely based on necessity, you know what I mean? Like, I would never act. Like, I'd never go in and be like, I want to act in something. And I just did it because it made sense, because I was around, for lack of a better term. Like, I was just, I could. So,
so you think if you had, like, doing another movie, if you had a bigger budget or more resources, you'd probably choose not to act in things?
I would not act, at least not in my own thing. I would definitely, if someone was like, hey, you could act. I mean, one of the things that always bothered me is the fact that I don't know that I'm necessarily not a good actor. Like, I don't know that I can't act, but it's one thing to act and one thing to like act and direct and be cinematographer and worrying about sound and thinking about the edit and thinking about the visual effects. Like, all of those things, it probably made me a better actor than I should have been, honestly. Like, when you're just acting and you don't have to think about all that stuff. But I don't really have, I'm not really that interested in acting. Like, I'm not a person who wants to necessarily be in front of the camera. Mm-hmm. I have stories I want to tell and characters that I want to show. And so acting was never that like overly interesting to me. So it became a challenge for me to really care about it, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? Like, to really go like, I want to really portray this character. And I think that's why the character is so truly reminiscent of me, is because I didn't want to act that much. So I had to just kind of write myself into it, or like a humorous, pathetic version of the way I see myself. Mm.
Yeah. So which made it's not about a kind of not wanting to act or wanting to act. It's just that You're happy to do it, but it's not your kind of key passion when it comes to filmmaking.
Not at all. And on set, everyone could probably feel that. And that's why they had to direct me and hold my hand in my performance. Not that I didn't try my hardest, but there are moments where I'm like, did I do a good job? I was too busy concentrating on what the visual effect was going to be, or what the other, you know, what I was going to do for sound, or what was going to happen. And I remember I have to give some like pretty big moments. And I remember Daniel saying to me, he's like, dude, you have to stop thinking, just do it. Just go big, just be that character. Especially once it gets to the end of the movie and I have to be a monster, basically. Daniel was just like, dude, don't even think about it. Just be it. I have the camera. We'll figure it out. You have to think entirely. You have to be in this mask and you have to be this monster. And that was fun. Honestly, that was really enjoyable to actually be able to shut it off, which is why I went, you know, when I got out of it, I'm like, you know what? Maybe if someone ever was like, hey, do you want to be in this thing? I would do it. But it's not my passion. Like, I would much rather be behind the camera filming and directing and telling crazy stories. I love the edit, though. I love editing. That's my favorite part. I think deep, deep, deep down, if you said, what's the one thing, you can only do one thing, I think I truly love editing.
Yeah. And do you find editing difficult at all? I always ask this question to any directors who also edit their work, just in terms of being precious about the work, or, you know, like creating that distance from the film. Effectively edit.
Yeah, I'm not precious about anything. Every moment where you move on from one thing to the next, I let it die. Like, I am not precious about the script at all. If there's a better way to do it, do it. Like, I do not need you to read my script verbatim. I do not need to do a scene the same. We can change it up. Like, I've had moments where we're sitting there looking at the script and we're like, why isn't this making sense? And we will rewrite an entire scene going, oh, that's right, this character would never do this, because we found the character while we were filming. You know, you find the character in the moment. What reads right on the page doesn't necessarily playwright on screen. So and then when I get to the edit, I don't look at the script again. I'm in the editing bay. I just start going through the footage and going like, okay, what works with what we have? Now granted, when I'm directing and I'm shooting, I'm often like jotting down mental notes or even literal notes going, this shot was the best, or I really think that we could change this up and this is how it should be edited. But finding in the edit, oh, that's really directing, is taking what you have and making something out of it. Oben is an area, right?
Yes. Oben's on the west coast of Scotland.
We were on the west coast, that area.
Okay.
And it was gorgeous.
Yeah, no, it's nice. It's nice up that way. Kind of northwest. It's a nice place. Okay, I can see why you would want to film there. Yeah.
And then we took my kids, me and my two boys went to Loch Ness, just because their crazy dad wanted to go to Loch Ness, just to say I'd been there. And I actually filmed some stuff at Loch Ness for some Greywoods plot promotional material that I never used, because I thought it'd be fun if Dom had gone to Loch Ness for one of his videos, and I just never used it.
Wow, that's a shame.
Maybe I will. I still have it all, so I could technically go back to it, and as the movie releases, maybe I'll use it for like a fun little, you know, bonus content piece. We're right now with Greywoods, we're like looking for distribution and whatnot, so you know, it could still be used.
Is it? I was also thinking, is it at all strange, like the kind of how these processes work? Of like, you know, like so I was looking at IMDb, and you know, the film was 2019, right? So it's like that's already 2 years. So like it's now going through the festivals, and I'm sure like you'll get distribution. And then is it weird to be talking about something you did like a couple years ago?
You know what? It isn't. It's okay. Weird. The weird thing is you know, saying it's a couple years ago is crazy, but it feels like yesterday. And like The Good Exorcist is the same way, where we're finally getting the movie released through Troma. I did that movie 4 years ago. Like, that should feel like forever ago, but it really doesn't, because these movies take time. Even the big movies, big budget movies, you know, you go into production and then the edit and putting it all together takes them 6 months to a year. By the time it releases in the theater, it's been, you know, it's been a year of production. And then by the time it hits Blu-ray and more people can see it, it's been another 6 months. So the process is something, this is what I've been telling to any like younger filmmakers who ask me the question of like, you know, well, how do you keep going? It's like, well, you have to love it so much that you're going to live with it for the rest of your life. Because it doesn't happen fast. This stuff takes forever. And you just have to come to terms with that, especially the post-production, the selling and the marketing. And you have to love it so much that you're willing to go on podcasts and talk about it over and over again and go to film festivals and talk about it. And it's easy to like hate the art when you've talked about it so much or when you've thought about it so much. But I don't. It's easy for me because these stories are stories I always wanted to tell and I finally get to. And now talking about them afterwards, it's just a blast.
I was also, when thinking about like the film, Greywood's plot, that is, I was wondering while you were making it, obviously it's the story you want to tell. Were you at all concerned that the audience wouldn't go with this kind of switch at the end? You know, like there's, you know, obviously there's a change of tone and a change of.
You think so? You think there's a change? No, I'm just.
Just a little bit of change of pace in the third act. And, you know, like it's just a little bit different. You know, it's mostly the same, obviously, but just a little.
That was the whole. My whole concept for this was when we went back and started rewriting the script. Because when I first started writing it, or like when we first went to go film it, this isn't the kind of movie it was supposed to be. We were trying to make like a mumblecore movie, like a kind of a dramedy, like a Duplass Brothers or like a Creep style movie. That was sort of what we were intending to make. And as we were working on it, we're just not those kind of people. I'm not that relaxed of a filmmaker. I like weird. I draw a picture and it's got fingers coming out of eyes and tentacles coming out of the back. I can't just do something in reality. And we realized that pretty quickly. Because the original concept for this movie was, it was two guys in the woods kind of just going on an adventure together. And then at the end of the movie, it ended with Miles walking up to finding Dom in the trees and he was turned into a Spider-Man. That was the original, and that's how it ended. And he said, we're going to be so famous. And then Miles starts to run away and gets hit with a bat and the movie just cuts there and ends. That was the idea. And then there was one more shot of Doug Greywood's walking down the street whistling and dropping off another video. That was like how the movie went. And when we started rewriting it, we had just so many more crazy ideas. And we were like, well, we want to see what happens to the monster. I want to see all this other stuff. And actually, spoiler alert, for anyone listening to this, sorry if you haven't seen the movie, but you got to watch it to understand like what we're talking about, really. But and it's fine if you haven't, because you'll love, when you see it, you'll be like, oh yeah, that's crazy. This actually kind of makes sense what they're talking about. But the dog man stuff all came from one of those improv scenes that Keith and I filmed while we were filming the first time. And it was the, do you remember the hay bale scene?
Yeah.
Where Keith is talking about like his favorite animal is a dog.
Yes. I remember.
And Miles, I keep calling him Keith. Miles. Keith is the actor's name. My friend Keith. Keith and I are 13 days apart in age. And we met each other. I met him when I was 13 days old and he was 1 day old, and we've been friends our entire lives. And Keith has that scene where this happened in improv while we were sitting on a hay bale. He said, my favorite animal is a dog. And I was like, a dog? That's like so fucking boring. Like everyone, this man's best friend, of course your favorite animal is a dog. Come up with something better. And we redid the scene later, but that scene was the one that like placed this idea into my mind that like Spider-Man, why a spider? I have arachnophobia, so that's why it was originally supposed to be a spider, but that really doesn't work into the plot all that well. And the dog boy made way more sense, like man's best friend doing this whole thing. So that one little moment of improv, it inspired the entire actual script.
It's funny how these turn of events happen, eh?
Oh, for this whole movie was that the whole like chained to the tree thing, how, you know, Dom is chained to the tree in that one sequence. That was literally Daniel and I were drunk after filming one day the first time around, and we found this tree that had a chain that was like grown into the tree. And he was like, dude, we should film here. This is what you're chained to. Like, you could be chained to this tree. And then Strauss, who was sober, we were like, dude, Strauss, can you drive us to Walmart? And we're going to go buy one of those dog chains and put it on my neck. That was just like spur of the moment. We had just too much to drink and decided to go for it and filmed, or like came back and filmed that sequence. And then 2 years later, when we went back to film again, that sequence, we redid it, but we had done like a rough draft of it the first time, but it was all just like, go with the flow and figure it out as you go.
Yeah. Okay. That's certainly sounds like an interesting process. I was also thinking, I obviously, you know, like, I don't like to talk about COVID too much on the show, but, you know, obviously it comes up. You know, I was with the festivals you've been at, have you actually managed to be at any of the festivals?
Yeah, man, I was so lucky with Fright Fest, because Fright Fest actually had a festival this year. And I was able to go to England and go to London and be a part of the festival and see my movie with the Fright Fest audience. And it was amazing. Like, it was one of the best experiences of my life, because Fright Fest is my dream festival. Like, that's the one that I always wanted to go to. And when we got in, I was like, this sucks. Well, we got in, but there's no way we're going. Like, there's no way in hell this is going to happen. And they kept pushing it, and they really were talking about, like, because they didn't get to do it the year before, I don't think. No, and then
it was completely digital. The 2020 edition was completely digital, but obviously the 2021 one was in person.
They were very adamant that it would be in person, and like they tried really, really hard to make it happen. And then finally, they announced like 3 weeks before the festival, they were like, We're going to do it in person. We're going to have all of these restrictions. Everyone has to get tested every day, all of this other stuff. But if people want to come, we're going to have a festival. It's going to be smaller, but we're going to do it. And my mom is in Greywood's plot, and my mom called me and she's like, I heard that they're going to actually have it. We need to go. And I'm like, Mom, we're not going to go. We have 3 weeks. How are we going to get flights, time off from work, all of this other stuff? There's no way we're going to go. And she's like, I'm booking our flight right now. And we went, my mom and I went to Fright Fest, and we got a hotel room like last minute. We pulled everything together, and it was seriously like the most fun I've ever had. It was so fun. And Greywood's plot screened on the last night. So it was like this huge event to like build up my anticipation to finally see my movie on the big screen at Fright Fest. And it went super well. You know, there were people who didn't like the movie, which is totally fine. I made a movie for no money that's black and white about a guy who gets turned into a dog man. I know what I made. It's not for everyone. But generally, the reaction was so great, and people just really got it at that festival. And we had, I don't know, it was so fun.
Yeah, it's supposed to be. I've only ever managed to go to a Glasgow Fright Fest. I never managed to get down to London. But, you know, obviously, like a lot of my horror friends back in the UK have been, and always tell me it's one of the best horror festivals you can go to.
It's just a very interactive festival. Like, the movies are great, and the way they curate it all, they don't just pander to their festival. I don't know. That's hard to explain, but a lot of festivals, they pick movies specifically because they're like, oh, this is going to pull in these people and this is going to get these people here. Fright Fest, they're very much like, what's the movie we want to show? Like, what do we want people to see that they may not see anywhere else? And that was really important to me. And it meant a lot that they picked our movie. And they were the sweetest guys in the world too. But then outside of it, like the gatherings at the bar, with COVID, it was a little bit tougher, but we still were all able to make it out. And I met some people who are like now great friends of mine. And it felt like camp for horror fans. It was really wonderful. But then, you know, on the other side of it, I've had probably 20 festivals we got into that I wasn't able to go to because of COVID over the past year and a half. And that's one of the reasons why the movie has taken so long to finish its festival run, because it's a slow process with COVID. And we're actually, I think the movie is screening, or it screened last week. I don't know when this episode's coming out, but screened last week at Horror Origins Film Festival, and it's doing like a digital screening right now. And we're coming to the end and hoping that like soon the movie can actually come out and we can find a distribution. But yeah, it's been a long journey through the festivals, and especially long because of COVID. But yeah, it is what it is. You roll with the punches. And I think the people who are dwelling on the fact that they didn't get to go to festivals and are getting more disappointed than using it as a chance to like think about what they want to do next, they're the people who, you know, it's going to be slower for them. But the people who are thinking positive and going like, okay, how do we come out of this gunning for something better? Those are the people who are going to move forward.
And actually, some of the films, it's that kind of weird double-edged sword, because it has been like, I've talked to a lot of filmmakers. It has been like a longer process with the festivals, and obviously not being able to attend is like a bummer. But a lot of these films have also been seen by like a slightly bigger audience. Because, for example, if you're not in London, you're not attending Fright Fest. Whereas like in 2020, when they went digital, all across the UK. So anybody, any horror fan anywhere in the UK could watch those films from home. So probably the 2020 batch got like more eyes. A lot of them got more eyes than they would have done, because it's seen by more people than can attend Fright Fest.
100%. And that's been a big thing for us, is a lot of these festivals we've got into, they'll do a screening still, and then they'll do a digital run of the movie. So people who would never make it out to the movie will get to see it. And that's what's been happening, is we've had people who see the movie who never would have gone to the festival before. We played at Chattanooga Film Fest. No, I don't remember what the festival was. One festival that I was like, we had so many people sending us messages telling us how much they enjoyed the movie. Like I was doing basically like Twitter Q&A, like just people DMing me and talking about the movie and stuff like that. And that never would have happened. Pre-COVID, it would have just been like, it would have played at that festival, 50 people would have seen it, and it would have been over. But this was like hundreds of people were seeing it. So there's definitely a positive to think. If you think about it positive, there are positives, which is weird to say. But you have to like, yeah, it's the bright side of it is you may get more eyes. And for the kind of weird movies that I'm making, it's definitely helping build the following I'm looking for, and finding the audience that I hope continues to watch it. And when we do hit a streaming service or Blu-ray or whatever, they're the people who will go like, I saw that at a festival, I want to show my friends.
So you mentioned a few times you're working on other things at the moment. How much can you tell us about your upcoming projects?
Well, I'm working on one movie I actually finished production on during the pandemic. While I was on Rebel Without a Crew, I had this like crazy idea that I was like, what is an actual Rebel Without a Crew movie? Because the reality is like the second you have people on set, they help. Like even if they're actors or whatever, they start picking up like how to help. And So my mind was like, well, what does a movie by one person look like? What is a true Rebel Without a Crew movie? So I started writing the script, and I actually wrote it while I was in Scotland. I finished the script while in Scotland. I had started it beforehand, and while I was there, I had some time to just sit down and write, and I finished it in Scotland. I filmed some sequences there, and then I came home, and this was September of 2019. And then I sent the script to Daniel in like December, because I in the movie, it's me in a basement. That's the whole point of the movie, was it was going to be me in a basement. And it's sort of my take on Omega Man. And so I started growing out my fingernails and my hair for the role. And I was, you know, maybe 5 months into growing out my fingernails and my hair. And I sent the script to Daniel, and I'm like, hey, man, I'm starting to look like an insane person for this role I'm doing by myself. Can you read the script and just give me the confidence that it's good enough that I should actually film it? And the script is called Scumbag. So I sent it to Daniel, and he called me, and he's like, dude, we have to go to dinner. So we go to dinner, and he's like, I sit down. I'm like, what? Well, what's up? He goes, dude, don't do it. Like, damn it, is it really that bad? And he's like, it's too good. I want to work on this. Please don't do this movie by yourself. Do it. I want to work on it. So by this point, I have like these 2-inch long fingernails with like this long, nasty hair. And I'm like, oh my God, man, I can't go much longer. My wife is going to divorce me if we don't like start. And he's like, just wait like a couple more months. We'll figure this out. We'll get a crew together and we'll do it right. This does not have to be your Rebel Without a Crew movie. 3 months later or 2 months later, COVID hits. And I was like, screw this. I'm going to film it myself. Or actually he called me, Daniel called me, and he was like, dude, just do it. Just film it. And I started filming. So I turned my basement into a bunker. And during the whole COVID, I filmed a movie by myself in my basement, and I'm editing it now. So that's called Scumbag, and I've been sort of putting it together on my Patreon and showing people the process, not recently because I've been in the process of moving, but my plan is to get back to it now and start showing off more of what I've been doing. And it's really fun and kind of insane to think that I'm making this movie by myself, but I'm having a hell of a time working on it. And then from there, beyond that, Daniel and I have been working on a script for a movie called Band-Aid Face. Title subject to change, and a couple of other weird projects, and I've got a couple scripts in the works that I'm trying to put together. But there's, you know, where I'm at that point where we're working on a bunch of things, including like just getting The Good Exorcist out on Blu-ray with Troma and getting Grey Woods Plot out to distribution.
It certainly sounds like you got an all in your plate there.
I do.
Is there any expected timeline for Scumbag? Will we see that in 2022?
Yeah, definitely in 2022. I was hoping to get it done by the end of the year, and I'm if I can really put down some serious time on it, I think I could get it done by the end of the year, but I also don't want to rush it. So I'm thinking it'll probably be playing at film festivals in 2022. If we can get into, if you know, who knows? It's such a weird thing, because when you're making no budget independent movies, you don't really know how the audience is going to react or how film festivals are going to react. It's one thing to have a budget and to have a studio backing you and have people behind you and have actors and names. But when you make something that's like black and white by 4 friends with no money in Minnesota, you don't know if anyone's going to care. So when someone like Fright Fest accepts the movie, you're like, you know, mind blown. In fact, I didn't send the Grey Woods Plot to Fright Fest. Daniel did, behind my back. I remember I got an email from Fright Fest that was like, you got in, like acceptance. It was an acceptance email. And I sent Daniel a message, an email, and I was like I forwarded it to him. And I was like, dude, look at this mistake. Fright Fest accepted our movie, and I didn't even send it. And I just got a message back that said, oops, I did. And I was like, oh my God, what? So, you know, you never know. So I'm not counting my chickens before they hatch with Scumbag, but I'm really hoping that people will be able to see it in the theater in 2022. And, you know, both because I don't know if it'll get in, but also who knows where we'll be at, you know, with the way things are kind of coming and going with COVID and theaters opening and closing and festivals running and not running. But yeah, 2022 is what I'm hoping for. And Daniel and I are doing some stuff with Band-Aid Face. If you're curious about Band-Aid Face, keep watching our, you know, Twitter and Instagram. And Daniel and I just started a TikTok called Flush Films. Never thought I'd be starting a TikTok, but we have some insane ideas for this TikTok. That if you're curious about what Band-Aid Face is, I would follow Flush Films on TikTok.
Flush Films on TikTok. And yeah, okay, before we wrap up the interview, do you want to give out the Twitter handles, Instagram handles, all that, so all my listeners can check out all the latest happenings on Scumbag and Band-Aid Face and you know, all the stuff that's kind of going to be coming out?
Yeah, it's funny, like the more and more I talk about these projects and stuff, the more I realize that I'm just like totally going the way of Lloyd Kaufman, just making like as many, making my own damn movies like left and right. Yeah. We're all over social media. I'm at Josh Stifter on Twitter, but we're starting to use our at Flush Studios more as well. We just started a TikTok called at Flush Films. And the reason is we had at Flush Studios, but it was connected to my Instagram. And apparently TikTok doesn't work with Instagram anymore. I don't know. We just started making this whole huge series of things for TikTok that we were super excited about, and then realized that, you know, they changed their whole way they work. At Flush Studios on Instagram. I have a Patreon, patreon.com/flushstudios, and that's where I post most of the behind the scenes stuff, because no one, like, DVDs and Blu-rays sadly have, you know, kind of fallen off, and it's harder to get them made, harder and harder with every day. I love Blu-rays and DVDs because of the bonus features. I'm a huge bonus feature fan, so I was trying to think of like what's a way to continue that. So I started a Patreon, and some of the stuff is free on Patreon, so if you want to check that out, you can see some cool behind the scenes for free on the making of Grey Woods Plot, the making of The Good Exorcist, and then hopefully soon the making of Scumbag. I think there are some really great Scumbag things on there too, though. So check out that Patreon. And then I think Flush Studios on Facebook. We're on all of the social medias.
Well, I recommend my listeners look you up on all those platforms. And it just leaves me to say thank you very much, Josh, for coming on the show. And once those things come out, you know, once you have further projects come out, feel free to come on the show again.
Oh, I would love to. I'd love to just sit down and talk about some horror movies and stuff too at some point, and like dive deep into the stuff before we started this episode, we were talking about some of our favorites. I'd love to come on and talk about that sometime.
Yeah. Well, I might set that up at some stage as well. I've been thinking recently as well about like the interviews that I've done with people about their films, like having guests back, just talking about horror influences, how they got into horror and favorites. So I was thinking maybe do some of those styles of interviews as well. So if I do that, I will message you again. But
that'd be fantastic.
That's all for this one. And we'll definitely catch you around.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was my guest Josh there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show, as well as thanking all of you out there who continue to listen and support to New Horror Express. And if you are one of those people and have not thus given us a rating, please consider giving the pod a 5-star review, as it really helps out with those old algorithms. Anyway, that's all for this time, but be sure to tune in next time when I'll be chatting to another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya!